Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri here with another virtual cup of coffee with top veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 292 with Chris Malaro.
It forced me to reminisce back to when I was serving in the Army and I was a platoon leader. After getting back home, a lot of us, myself included, were seen by physical therapists. And there were a few soldiers that screened positively for mental health concerns. And, you know, I had one soldier in particular that was screened positively, that was referred to a specialist and didn't get the help that he was one of those 60%, right, that didn't follow up. And no one knew the better because no one was following up with him to see what was going on. How was his depression improving? It turned out he didn't fill his antidepressant. He went to the emergency room twice and no one connected these dots.
Although Chris is an entrepreneur in the digital health software space, there is something in this episode for every veteran. We talk about making sure that you are running towards something in your career rather than running away from something. We talk about how to find a co-founder. We talk about Chris's own founding story, and it's a good one, which draws deeply from his military experience. We talk about how failure is not really failure if you learn something new and become better. And I know this is advice that sounds pretty, but it is actually extremely messy, painful, and often embarrassing while still being true. We talk about being flexible in your career and not just sticking to an idea or aspiration that no longer serves you. And we talk about the power of understanding your own mission and intent and how to apply this to your career. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss, as well as a text transcript of the interview, thanks to Kathleen Dillon. Special thanks to Chris Diaz of episode 226, who made the introduction to Chris for this episode. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Chris. Well, joining me today in Philadelphia is Christopher Malaro. Chris, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
So for listeners, I wanted to give a quick background on Chris. He's the CEO and co-founder of the digital health software company Neuroflow, which uses advanced data analytics from wearables to objectively measure mental states and emotions for behavioral health, wellness, and performance applications. He started out at West Point, after which he served for 5 years as a field artillery army officer. After transitioning off active duty, Chris co-founded the veteran literacy nonprofit, Things We Read, and received his MBA as a graduate of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. So maybe to start things off, Chris, could you take us back to when you decided to leave the Army, how you approached that, and what that first transition was like?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's crazy how fast time flies, because it seems like yesterday I was in the Army, and it's hard to believe that this August will be 4 years since my last day on active duty. I can't believe it. Looking back to that time, you know, the decision to get out wasn't an easy one by any stretch of the imagination. I loved being in the Army for a lot of reasons, probably similar to a lot of listeners do. The camaraderie, getting to do something different every day. I mean, getting to do something challenging. For personal reasons, with my wife and other professional aspirations, we decided to make the transition. And for me, you know, the best advice I was given by a mentor of mine, Brigadier General Banks, who's the Vice Dean of Kellogg Business School now, he said, look, if you want to transition out, I fully support that. I'm not going to be like one of the other, you know, the military high-ranking colonels or generals that try to persuade you otherwise. I think it's fantastic if you have goals to do outside of uniform, but make sure that you're running to something, not away from the military. Mm. And that really stuck with me. I think that caused me to have a tactical pause and make sure that I was getting out for the right reasons with a plan. And anyway, so that when I applied to business school, I made the commitment with my wife to say, look, I'm only going to transition out and put in my separation papers if I'm accepted to one of these business schools, because then that's something next on the horizon. And if we didn't get accepted to the, any of the schools, then we would continue with the Army and you know, kind of do a reorientation at that point. So anyway, that obviously I was found my way into the back door of Wharton somehow, and we made the transition.
That's great. I mean, I can relate to, even with jobs, that thought of it, it's so much better to be moving towards something than moving away from something. I think it's just nice to have something that you want and that you're excited about. Could you talk about, we'll rewind in a second and talk about how you got here, but to lay the foundation, how would you explain what NeuroFlow is?
So the description that you gave earlier was spot on in terms of we're obviously a software solution. We integrate with a lot of wearables, but the wearables aren't ours. We use Apple Watches and Fitbits and everything. And we were really focused on the wearables when we first got started, basically being on this journey for a little less than 3 years now. We've grown and iterated and evolved quite a bit. And where the platform sits today, we integrate behavioral and mental health services into any care setting, physical health settings like physical therapy and pain management, primary care settings. We're used a lot in OBGYN settings for postpartum depression. Mm. And the thought process is, and there's tons of evidence to show this and support this, that, you know, one is, mental health affects physical health and vice versa. If you have a chronic physical illness or a pain condition, there's a very high likelihood that you also have symptoms of depression or anxiety or PTSD from trauma or something like that. And it affects your outcomes and your higher utilizers of the health system. And so if we can get a handle on our mental health and resiliency and our overall wellness, it will improve healthcare everywhere across the continuum of care. And so our platform bridges that divide. We make those resources readily available into medical doctors' offices and help make the very valuable resources available to patients everywhere.
That's great. And I totally agree with that thought of like the way that the mind and body are connected. And I think it's great to see how that's being addressed simultaneously. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like addressing one side of your body without the other side. And so it's great that it's this holistic approach. And I had read, and for listeners in the show notes at beyondtheinformed.org, I'll have a ton of different articles about NeuroFlow. But one of the ones I had read was from The Inquirer. And I think what it described was almost like a headset that this 8-year-old boy or this young child wore that tracked through the night how he was sleeping and what his emotional state was, because he was having some sort of difficulty there. Could you share just a couple concrete examples of like that, or what specifically it looks like in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So the headset that you're referencing in that article is another one of those another example of those wearables that we integrate with. So the headset that the Inquirer article talks about is called the Muse headset. And it is a 5-electrode EEG headset that's Bluetooth enabled. So it's wireless, and it reads your prefrontal cortex of your brain, which is highly correlated to your emotional states. And so we could measure the real-time brainwave activity to quantify the stress and the relaxation levels of patients. So that, one, they can understand their emotional state, but then also providers can in a more objective, measurable way. Like I said, the wearables have become a nice add-on feature. We're kind of at a point in the marketplace where we're finally recognizing that mental health and physical health deserve the same kind of investment and attention. We're still not at the place where a lot of people are comfortable with wearables or measuring and reading their brainwaves. So to give an example of how our technology works in a pain management setting, let's use as an example. So if I'm being seen for chronic pain, I might be seen on a monthly basis or every 90 days are usually the standards. And, you know, the doctor will, I'll go in, I'll see the doctors, how are you doing? How's your pain level? Here's another prescription for pain meds. You know, maybe here's some physical therapy or an injection or something like that. And they may or may not measure my depression or anxiety level with some scales, some like the PHQ-9 or the GAD-7.
And that's like self-described, right? Is that kind of like the equivalent of like on a scale of, or you're answering like questionnaires to determine that, or?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. They're questionnaires. Yep. So they're well-researched, validated questionnaires. I mean, you don't even, you know, they've done a lot of research in people trying to game a floor, to game them, like answer the way that you think you should to show a lower depression. And they're very, very difficult to game like that. So let's say hypothetically someone goes in there, let's say I'm a patient and I screen positively for depression, right? Very mild, but I'm still positive on the positive scale for depression. Today, the doctor may say, Chris, like, you also have depression. We should get you to a therapist because that depression is most likely affecting your pain as well. And then that's it. And then they're like, they give me a slip, say, here's a couple of therapists that you can go see. They may even write me an antidepressant, but that's it. And there's no follow-up with that. Mm. There's no follow-up with how's your depression progressing. We know that 60% of patients that are given a referral to a behavioral health specialist will never even go to their first appointment. Not their first.
60%.
60%.
Wow, that's wild.
Mm. So that's where we kind of come into the play here, and we automatically follow up with the patients. We make sure they're going to get the resources and access to the resources that will are empirically proven to get a handle on their depression and to improve their outcomes. And what's really super exciting is that not only does it improve their behavioral health outcomes, but it also improves their pain outcomes as well.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's what we're doing today with clinics around the country.
So where did this all come from? Like, can you pinpoint a moment that was the birth of this idea?
Yeah. So there are two main points that occur. So my first year of my MBA program, I'm in this technology fellowship. It's like an internship type situation. And there's a bioengineering PhD student that's also in that same program. And me and him get to know each other. And University of Pennsylvania has a business plan competition. And they say, come up with the next best technology and business plan that can help the healthcare system. So we start brainstorming different ideas that we can do. And that caused me to jog my memory of figuring out from my personal experience, where have I seen gaps in care? And so that moment in time is very defining in NeuroFlow's history, but it forced me to reminisce back to when I was serving in the Army, and I was a platoon leader. I had the privilege of not only serving in the Army, but getting to lead a platoon of soldiers who I still try to keep in touch with today. You know, we had deployed to Iraq, and after getting back home, a lot of us, myself included, were seen by physical therapists, right? We're trying to get back to a 100% condition. And there were a few soldiers that screened positively for mental health concerns. And, you know, I had one soldier in particular that was screened positively, that was referred to a specialist and didn't get the help that he was one of those 60%, right? That didn't follow up. And no one knew the better because no one was following up with him to see what was going on. How was his depression improving? Turned out he didn't fill his antidepressant. He went to the emergency room twice and no one connected these dots to say like he has depression and PTSD, but isn't getting the appropriate care for himself. And, you know, he lost his battle to depression and became a statistic. He became one of those 20 veterans that we read about. Mm. And, you know, that was, it was a defining moment when I was a platoon leader, because to this day, it was it's my biggest leadership failure, frankly, because I think that situation could have been avoided if we had the appropriate monitoring tools and the appropriate access and engagement to these different types of care for him. But I didn't, at that point when I was a lieutenant, I didn't think it was going to lead to starting this company. It wasn't until I was in Penn and I recalled that memory that I said, I think that that's something that we can help. Anyway, Adam, who's that PhD, who's now my co-founder, we submitted the business plan to the competition. I think we had like a week to do the business plan. So needless to say, we didn't even make it to the next round. I think they laughed at it, but we thought that there was a real opportunity there to help the situation. And so we stuck with it and, you know, here we are today.
I love how it's born out of this insight of saying like, okay, we as a country even are failing people who are hurting, in that we're not, I almost view it as like bumper bowling, like we're not making it easier for them to get the help that they need. We're making it too easy for them to fall outside of help, and we're not giving them the support that they really deserve to become better. And so I love that pinpointing of that pain point from a very personal experience, then years later drives you to realize like, oh, there's maybe a solution here. And I also love, I was expecting, you know, you kind of submit the business plan and then you get funding and that's it. But I even respect more that, you know, you do this and it, you know, you get laughed out of the room. And I'm wondering, how did you know to persist in spite of that? Because that is like a very early on failure, or maybe some negative validation. And I can imagine with all this ambiguity, someone else might have said like, ah, you know what, maybe this isn't a great idea after all. So how did you guys decide to continue to pursue this?
The funny thing is, I guess we didn't know it at that point, but there would be a lot more failures to come that we would endure, that we'd learn from. And I don't know, I just think that the mentality that we've approached at the time, my co-founder and I, but now the team, we're a team of close to 30 employees. We try to approach this in the same mentality of, you know, with every failure, a failure is not really a failure if you learn something new from it and you can become better for it. And as cliche as that may sound, and may be, it really is the truth. I mean, so we got a lot of really good feedback from that business plan competition that we lost, in terms of they asked a lot of really good, tough questions that we didn't have the answers to. But now at least we knew the questions that they were going to ask that we needed to think around. And so to answer your question, though, about why did we persist and how did we find the mental strength to want to continue, I think like because it wasn't about our solution, it wasn't about our business plan, it was about the problem we were solving. And if you looked at the statistic, part of the business plan is you did a bunch of market research, you looked at the statistics and how big this opportunity was, and it just became apparent that, you know, from a dollar and cents perspective, we're talking about $100 billion opportunity in terms of mental health disorders in the country. From a human perspective, you're talking about 1 in 5 Americans a year struggle with this, and that's the ones that we know of. So that's 45, 50 million people a year aren't getting the appropriate care, and they're struggling in many cases in darkness. And so, you know, when those two things come together, when it makes sense from a financial perspective, I mean, when it makes sense from a human capacity perspective, and then when no one really has done it yet, the stars just aligned that we said, well, let's get our, you know, let's get our shit together, for lack of a better term, and put a better business plan, together, because there is a real opportunity here. And you know, that's what drives us to, you know, to this day.
That's great. And I think that's a lesson for listeners, whether or not you aspire to entrepreneurship, that what I would call an iterative process of applying that business plan, getting rejection, learning about the weaknesses, and then shoring up those weaknesses. That's the same for job interviews. That's the same for pretty much any career path. But I think that your story, Chris, is a really good example of that, of just it's, you know, I always think of the weightlifting analogy of you're tearing muscle and rebuilding it stronger and tearing it and rebuilding it. And I'm sure you went through that process hundreds of times in this business plan. And then the other thing that's probably a little bit more apropos for aspiring entrepreneurs is, you know, you kept on coming back to, this is a big market size. This is a big problem. There's a lot of people we can serve by finding this solution, which isn't always necessary. But if you're looking to start a business that can grow, it's certainly a very, very foundational component. So I love that you said, hey, this is, you know, this is a massive problem that you experienced firsthand and that you saw the numbers were representative across the world in the United States. That's great. Was there a turning point for you? Like I had read that you your first round essentially was from winning, I think, 10 or more different business competitions. So I'd love to learn more about that. But also, like, more importantly, was there a point at which you felt like the momentum started to be in your favor?
Yeah. So one, to build on what you said a second ago about the iterative process and whatnot, I mean, point in case about iteration and learning and adjusting is the fact that we've evolved and added so many more capabilities beyond just the wearables. Like, we still have the wearables there and those are doing those things. But if we kind of stayed course and said, no, we're just going to do these wearables, we wouldn't be in business today, frankly, because the market didn't, it was too early for the market. It was almost like, you know, before, if Apple tried to create the personal computer 10 years before they launched in 1979, it would have been too early. The world wasn't ready for it. The technology wasn't there yet. And so in the healthcare system, you had a lot of early adopters that were willing to try it out and wanted to use this and see it and do a lot of research with it. But on a massive scale, in terms of, like, you know, your regular customers, they just weren't really ready for that yet. And so we were able to take that feedback, be honest with ourselves, and adjust accordingly. And that's what, you know, eventually led us to this point. And that also leads to your question about the fundraising perspective. I mean, it was, to say it was a slog, it is an understatement. The fundraising world is another animal in and of itself. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. I mean, there's certain variables that you need to hit, but a lot of it's just emotional. Does the investor like you and believe in you as a person? And so we had a real tough time raising our first investment round, so tough that it wasn't really an option. And because you have to find a way anyway, we competed in these business plan competitions nationally and ended up winning $150,000 of all free money, no strings attached, just to keep the ship afloat, so to speak, hiring interns to build prototypes and those sort of things, which was just enough to get us to a point where, you know, a real investor was willing to put larger capital behind this. And that's what led us to our first fundraising round of $1.25 million. But that $1.25 million round took maybe 12 months to raise, talking to investors, keeping them updated, hearing no's way more than yeses, and you know, just finding a way to stay alive, for lack of a better term, until we were able to close that investment round.
I love that resilience. And the two things I'll kind of point out, first for entrepreneurs, aspiring entrepreneurs, but then abstracting it, because I think it has a broader implication, is I love that you start with this idea of the wearable, and then you recognize, and I imagine it's a painful and difficult recognition, but you realize that's not where the business needs to go. And so you reluctantly let go of that and move on. And I can share from my own experience as an entrepreneur, times when I was more in love with my product than with my customer. And if I was in love with who I was serving, I would have been willing to ditch this beautiful product in order to build the company that they needed and deserved. And instead, I kind of persisted in my love of my product and missed a market opportunity. And, you know, abstracting that for all listeners, I would say there's also this thought of, like, being committed to your goal, but not holding it so tightly. And by that, I mean, like, maybe your goal is to provide for your family, or maybe your goal is to look after veterans in some way. That can take a lot of different forms. And I think sometimes we can get fixated on one particular career path, when in truth, there's many different roads to get to that waypoint. And then the second, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, like, to tie it into the military vernacular and the experiences, you know, we could talk about this a lot more. There's a ton of examples of where I look back. I'm not even purposely doing it, but if I'm like do a retrospective on what we did, so much of what we do and our strategy was born from experiences from the military. One of which being the this iteration of understanding what our mission is and intent, right? Mm-hmm. We all know operation orders in the Army, you have the mission and the commander's intent. And so as long as you're accomplishing the mission and you're meeting the intent, it doesn't really matter how you get there, as long as you get there. And so in the course of, if you're in Iraq and you're trying to secure a town, and you have a whole beautiful mission set up, and like you're going to go down this route and then flank this position. When it hits the fan, that mission goes out strategy goes out the door, and you're just getting the mission done at that point and meeting the intent. And so it's kind of the same thing, just in the startup world. Right?
I love that.
Different battlefield.
No, I love that framework. I think that's really exceptional. And then the other point is Chris, I think, is representing here resilience. And I would say that of the 280 plus people who have been on the show, rarely is it a straightforward path, and rarely is it a slam dunk success from the start. And I say that for every potential career path, not just entrepreneurship. And I think it's good for listeners to go into either your transition out of the military or leaving a job into the next one, realizing it's going to take more job interviews than you think. It's going to take more applications. It's going to take more coffee chats. Everything is going to be more difficult than you assume. And I think if you adopt that mindset, maybe you'll be surprised and it's easier, but at least you kind of go in knowing that it's a slog for everyone. It's very rarely this downhill coast. And the one last thing I'd say in that too is, I think most of us coming from the military, we don't want a coast. We don't want it to be easy. It's almost like if you were to just kind of out of the gates get the funding, or out of the gates get your dream job, maybe your sights are too low, or maybe you're not going in the right direction. And we all like a challenge because we grow from that. So I hope it's encouraging for people and not discouraging to hear stories like Chris's, where it's not just this instant success. And it sounds like, Chris, even once you obtained through, you know, beg, borrowing, and stealing this $150,000, it's not like you were then out of the woods. It's not like all your problems were solved. Like, where did things go from there?
Not at all. In fact, it just kept us alive enough so that we can experience real problems to come. Mm-hmm. I equate to being in a startup company kind of is like playing a video game. And so each time you beat a level, you go to the next level, which is a little bit harder than the last level that you just beat. And so, with bigger money, with bigger clients or bigger fundraises or bigger companies, when you hire more employees, bigger problems tend to come with them. And so when we had that $150,000, first of all, that didn't come in one slog, right? So it was 10K here, and then we'd spend that over the next course of 2 months, and then we'd win 20K, and we'd spend that over the course of 2 months. And there were many, many cases that we didn't know if we would be able to pay our interns, and we told them, like, please stick with us. Like, I promise that this is going to be worth it in the end. In fact, we had all of our interns, some of them were master's level, some of them were bachelor's levels, but they were all going to graduate in May. And I told them not to look for jobs because I wanted to hire them full time. And they agreed to that. And then what that put pressure on us was, now we actually had to raise a finance round so that we could make sure to pay their salary and give these folks jobs that we had promised them. Kudos to them for trusting me, or maybe they were just blind to the, and as excited about the mission as I was. But we ended up closing that round, and then we're able to kind of move forward from there. Now, when you raise a fundraising round, the new challenge is it's not just you, you're accountable to investors. Mm. And so all of a sudden as the CEO and the co-founder of this company, I have a boss, and that boss are the people that gave us the money and are expecting growth and a return and to meet milestones. And you know, that was, you know, that was a steep learning curve that to this day, I'm still learning a lot from that. And we're about to raise our Series A round later this year. So we're going to raise a $10 million round later this year. And
wow.
That process has already started for us. So we're already talking to investors and that sort of stuff. And, you know, when you get to go to work each and every day and say you're learning something new and gaining a new skill set, I get to do that every day. And it's very special.
Mm. What does your day-to-day look like? I'm assuming your co-founder plays more of the traditional kind of like technical co-founder and you're more on the business side. I'm curious if that's accurate. And then if you could just take us through what a representative day might be like.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's not a technical in the sense of being a software engineer. He's a bioengineer and he comes with a lot of, you know, what we say is he's the fine print guy and I'm the strategic guy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's making sure that every day we're getting our daily tasks accomplished, that we're on track for keeping our current customers happy and successful. While I'm out there raising funding, I'm trying to get new clients and we both kind of tag team the hiring aspect of things, which have really now become a full team effort because, you know, we're hiring another engineer. Our engineering team is 8 engineers, so that, you know, they should have a lot of say in terms of who they're going to work with. So that, you know, overall, I'm strategy and he's tactical, if you want to put it in the military terms. And, you know, from a day-to-day aspect, that is probably the most impossible question to answer because it's always different. So I, you know, typically I'll have a various calls set up or meetings set up. I tend to travel a lot, not because I would have to, but I always prefer face-to-face meetings. So if a CEO of a hospital is interested in using NeuroFlow, I'd much rather have a face-to-face coffee chat with him or her rather than a call. So, you know, it's whatever we're doing from from day to day, it's always putting out many fires, making sure that we have forward progress and making sure that first and foremost, our customers and the patients that are using the platform, we're up to over 10,000 now have been invited to the platform, are happy with their experience.
Mm. Tell me if this is correct, but one of the things I perceive about your business that I love businesses that are like this is you're kind of one degree removed from the front lines. And it's not like you're manufacturing the hardware that's used. You're manufacturing the software that integrates with lots of different hardwares, which seems like it de-risks the business a little bit because you're like the you're the Wizard of Oz. You're like the person behind the curtain making use of these devices and really focusing on the analytics and in the interpretation of the information that they're collecting. Is that somewhat accurate?
Yeah, I think that's actually, so an analogy I use in like when we're in a sales meeting with a doctor, I say, you know, usually I tell my story and how I got involved with this in the first place. And I said, well, coming from the military, I view you as the doctor, the provider, as being on the front lines. Mm. You are doing, you know, you're doing the hard work day in and day out to accomplish your mission, which is taking care of patients. I view myself as a support element in helping you do that more effectively. Mm. You know, I think that resonates with them, and it certainly puts it in the perspective for me and the rest of our team to always appreciate kind of where we are in that mix and what our mission is to do every day. Because frankly, you know, when it comes to our technology really doesn't mean anything. I mean, to your point, it's not about our product, it's about the customer. Mm-hmm. And so as long as we're solving their problems and making them more effective, then we're doing our job, whether that's with our technology or if we can manually do something for them. I mean, I've had some of our customer success officers, myself included, have gone on site with doctors to help make sure that them and their patients knew how to use the technology. And when you're in a technology company, hopefully you don't have to do that, but we're, mm-hmm. you know, we're dedicated enough to want to do that, at least in these early days, so that we're successful, they're successful, and the mission's accomplished.
And one of the age-old questions I'd love your feedback on is, for people who aspire to entrepreneurship, whether or not to pursue an MBA. And what advice would you have for listeners approaching that decision?
So it's absolutely not necessary. You can learn everything that you need to be as an entrepreneur on the job. And if you're coming from the military, 90% of your skills in the military are applicable to being an entrepreneur. I mean, if you think about it, as a CEO, I have to make the strategy and the vision for the company. Then I have to put the best people on my team to execute that strategy and vision. And then I have to make sure that we have the resources and that we're to get it done and that we're actually on target for the mission. To me, that sounds a lot like being in a military, executing a mission, making sure that we have the ammunition and the food and the fuel, that we have the properly trained people and that we have the right mission design, or the right strategy designed to accomplish our mission. It's this very similar. So an MBA is not necessary. The reason why I chose to do the MBA, and looking back on it, I think I would do it over again, is because it's, you know, similar to the military. You're not going to enlist right away and then be deployed the next day, right? You're going to have a certain amount of training so you can become proficient with the basics, that you can work on the building blocks of being a proficient soldier before fighting a war. And it's the same aspect of being in the business world. I didn't feel personally that I had the basics down to be proficient in being a business leader. I mean, I didn't know what these terms like pre-money, post-money, capitalization tables. You could research those and Google those and teach yourself, that's fine. But I wanted some sort of formal training behind that stuff before I felt comfortable taking investors' money and before I felt comfortable hiring people that were going to view Neuroflow as their full-time jobs. And so that, looking back on it, I loved my MBA experience. It was a phenomenal experience. It was a lot of fun. I have some of my best friends from the experience, and I would do it over again. If I'm being honest, I don't think it's a requirement.
And what advice do you have about finding and vetting a co-founder? Were you like in a class and you were sitting next to each other and you like kind of look at each other like, hey, do you want to work together on this project? Or how did you, what advice do you have about how someone might find that co-founder?
So again, he was in the engineering school for his PhD and I was in the business school, and there's kind of this weird, this weird environment on Penn's campus with Wharton and the rest of the other schools. So Wharton, the business school, is almost in its bubble. They call it the Wharton bubble. So you can easily, if you're in Wharton, you can easily go to business school and never talk to anyone else in the rest of the school and be fine. I mean, I think most people do that. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to get other experiences with the engineering school, with the law school, the medical school. And so I purposely put myself into certain clubs and fellowships that would force me to have those other interactions. And so I was in this one fellowship called the Insight Fellowship. And it was a technology fellowship where we collaborated with other schools on technology projects. And that's where Adam, my co-founder, was also a part of that fellowship. And so the question is then, that's where we met and how we met. How we decided we'd be adequate partners in being in this marriage together. Because frankly, that's what it is. Me and him we're both married, but we spend so much more time with each other than we do with our wives. And we're, when it comes down to it, we're very similar in the sense that we both have passion for what we're doing. We both see the vision, and we both have a certain amount of patience and perseverance in order to move forward and drive forward. That's where our similarities end. We're very complementary from a skill set perspective. Like, he's much more patient. He's much more level-headed. I mean, he was in his PhD program. I could never get my PhD, I don't think. So he's much, you know, we're very, very different in the way that we think. You don't have to look different. Me and him, we even look different. I mean, he has I don't have any tattoos. He has a giant sleeve tattoo. I mean, we're just very, if you looked at the two of us side by side, you would say they're business partners. But then when you get to know us and you work and, you know, with the way that we work together on the team, it is, it's just such a complementary relationship where my strengths are his weaknesses and his strengths are my weaknesses. And so we fill those gaps in for each other, and together we make a great founding team.
Are there any resources that have helped you? That could be books, podcasts, movies, conferences, anything that you would recommend to listeners, especially thinking of those who are maybe deployed right now, something that they could get their hands on in the next couple of weeks that has helped you?
Yes, absolutely. I didn't always love reading, but I read my favorite book that I, one of my favorite books is Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. That book inspired me and a fellow platoon leader to start the company, the nonprofit Things We Read, to try to inspire soldiers that same newfound love that I had. Anyway, that sent me down this rabbit hole of asking other leaders and business leaders and entrepreneurs what their favorite books are. And so, I mean, Zero to One by Peter Thiel is a great one. Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. I love that book. It's great just to kind of get a sneak peek into one of the greatest technology and entrepreneurs' minds of our, you know, generation, maybe of all time, is great. There's Grow Bigger. I forget who the author is there, but Grow Bigger is a book about entrepreneurship and growing your business and kind of having this bigger mentality. Having the mentality right now, even Neuroflow is only 30 employees, acting like you're 300 or 3,000 employees and growing into that mentality. Grow Bigger is a fantastic one. I love podcasts. How I Built This with Guy Raz on NPR. Reid Hoffman does one, Masters of Scale. Reid Hoffman is the founder of LinkedIn. And then if you're an entrepreneur and you're thinking about starting your own businesses, there's a bunch of resources out there specifically for veterans. Bunker Labs has been a big resource for us in terms of just networking and being in, introduced to investors and that sort of thing. I mean, I guess long story short, I could go down. There's a much longer list than what I just labeled. There's a ton of resources out there. And so, you know your needs and your interests and kind of what gaps you need to fill. But if you do the research and you poke around enough, you'll find what you need out there to help you.
That's great. And for listeners, I'll have all of those linked to in the show notes for the episode. Also, I'll have a link to the founder of Bunker Labs was on the show, and I'll put his episode in there because there's a lot to learn from that organization. And I love too just the thought of, and I think a lot of guests talk about this on the show, I think when you leave the military, it's accepting that you are 100% responsible for your own education, your own learning. And at least my experience in the military was a lot of that was given to me. I was given training. I was told what I needed to know. And it was just kind of like eating the food that was given to me. And I love this thought of transitioning to saying like, oh, I need a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that. And I think that Chris laid out a bunch of great resources for you. So I know we're at the end of the time, and I always like to keep the last question open-ended. And you could approach this either as, what have we not covered that you want to make sure listeners know, or what's just something you really want to leave them with before we wrap up?
I guess it's kind of related to both. I mean, there's this common theme in society right now, I think, about like hire vets and do the right thing for your country, and you want to give a veteran a job. And I appreciate, I think, where society, especially civilian society that hasn't served, is what they're trying to accomplish and what they're trying to say. But I think that the message is slightly off, and what veterans should understand, especially that haven't transitioned or in the middle of transitioning, maybe just transitioned, is that your biggest strength and your biggest differentiator is the fact that you're a veteran and have that military experience. And that is not, that is, if that sounds cliche, I'm sorry, but it's the absolute truth. I think my biggest differentiator as a founder of a company is the fact that I have this perspective and experience of leading in the Army and dealing with the toughest situations and the toughest circumstances and having to figure out a way. I mean, there's nothing more applicable in the business world than that. The stakes are obviously different, but being able to translate that experience into being successful in your next career, in your next chapter, sometimes I think an unfair differentiator, and you should use that to the best of your advantage. I think that sometimes that's underappreciated, undersaid, but it's important.
That's great. Well, Chris, I really appreciate you being on the show. And for listeners, there is no shortage of resources about what Chris is up to. His company has gotten a lot of recognition and publicity. And so if you're interested in learning more about his company or his path, check that out. And as well, if you're interested in this for you or someone you served with or anything like that, I believe you were on Dwayne France's Headspace and Timing podcast as well. And I know Dwayne was on the show. He does a lot of work around veterans' mental health. But chances are, statistically, if you're listening to this, either you would benefit from something like this or someone you served with would as well. So it's worth taking a deeper dive.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Surface. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. Every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that.
Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, there is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly. And the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.